Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. Our guest today is Dr. Carlos Smith. Dr. Smith, a general dentist and ethicist, is also the Associate Dean of Ethics and Community Engagement and an Associate Professor in the Department of Dental Public Health and Policy at Virginia Commonwealth University School of Dentistry. He serves as President of the American Society for Dental Ethics, as a member of the Board of Directors of the Academy of Professionalism in Healthcare, and the lone dentist on the CVS Health National Health Equity Advisory Board. Dr. Smith completed clinical pastoral education at Duke Medical Center, with an emphasis on providing care and crisis management to families of cardiac pediatric patients. Armed with degrees from Hampton University, the University of Michigan School of Dentistry, and Duke Divinity School, he speaks and publishes extensively on professionalism and dental ethics, including issues across the oral health workforce, such as provider well-being and burnout, the history of racism in healthcare, and inclusive excellence in dental education. He serves as a program director of a recently awarded Health Resources Services Administration grant for the in-house development of a VCU School of Dentistry Dental Faculty Loan Repayment Program, with direct costs just under $1 million, which after 5 years will eliminate the student debt of 5 faculty members. He remains committed to clinical care, continuing practice within the VCU dental faculty practice. Let's have a very warm Bioethics in the Margins welcome to Dr. Smith.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So yeah, let's dive in. It's not actually, I think you are our first dentist, actually, in the Bioethics in the Margins universe. So we're really excited. And before we start to dive in into your scholarship and to pick your brain about a few things, how did you be about a dentist and a bioethics? I know the abbreviated version, right? What led you in your journey to this particular point? Any influences, any moments of epiphany, if you will, about how you mesh bioethics, but also that with dentistry?
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent question. I think like many folks who go into the health professions, as a young person, I wanted to be a doctor. I had the privilege of growing up in Columbia, South Carolina, which has a long storied history of kind of a Black professional class. So although my family, immediate family, didn't have healthcare practitioners within it, there were lots of Black dentists, lots of Black physicians in Columbia. So this notion of not seeing what I wanted to become was not my narrative or not my journey. Like, I saw a lot of what I wanted to become. So it felt very plausible. It felt very tangible. It felt like it was something within one's grasp or reach. So I had the opportunity, a lot of friends growing up whose parents were cardiologists or OBGYNs. And I recognized early enough that I did not like the smell of the hospital. And so that is honestly one of the things that got me to think about dentistry and oral health. And all the dentists I knew were happy. When I shadowed physicians initially, both in high school and in college, it was kind of the bemoaning of HMOs and sort of the early transition of folks not being able to own their own practices in medicine. And all the dentists were happy and jolly. And you know, they were just, I guess, living the life, as it were. So I think on some level, that certainly catapulted me to thinking about oral health care. I would say an epiphany moment came when I was in dental school. I come from a long line of educators and clergy, and so I felt this sort of religiosity sort of baked into like my Black Southern cultural fabric. But at the same time, very much was debating like, teeth are important, but like, you know, eternal destinations and humanism and these larger ethereal thoughts, I guess, started to consume me. And I think at my core, I am much more of a humanities inclined person naturally than I am hard science. And so I had to really work at science. I had to really work at the biophysics stuff. Whereas like writing papers in history class and things like that were so natural. So probably if I could go back in time, I might redo the journey. But yeah, so I came to an epiphany, and honestly, my chaplain, I went to undergrad at Hampton, as you said, my chaplain at Hampton was an English professor, but also our chaplain. And I reached out to him when I was in dental school because I thought I was going to drop out and go to seminary. And he said, well, why do you have to pick one? And I said, isn't that what you have to do? He said, well, who told you you had to pick? Why can't you do both? Why don't you finish one and then allow life to happen and then do something else, do the second thing? So that's exactly what I did. I stayed the course with dental school, completed dental school. I thought I would go to seminary much later in life once I had a white picket fence and all the good trappings that we so desire in life at times. But really and truly just had an opportunity to go almost immediately. So I finished dental school, took a year off, and then went into my seminary of theological studies, practiced dentistry while also a full-time Master's of Divinity student at Duke. At that time, there was no hybrid night program or anything like that. So I really just had a fortunate opportunity to practice in what we call community health or rural public health. I worked in a community clinic where my supervisor had actually done residency with a longtime mentor of mine. And she basically said, hey, bring me your schedule at the beginning of the semester and we will build your patient schedule around your seminary studies. And so it was a very unique, I'm very blessed in that regard. But I think I always had larger questions than simply oral health, right? How does this align with the totality of a person? And even the work I do now is to ensure that we cultivate lifelong learners, but we cultivate clinicians that recognize, okay, someone has sat in my chair and they have maybe these 28 teeth, but they're not solely this tooth, right? They have a whole narrative, a whole trajectory that's connected throughout their journey, how they got to me, how they view me. A lot of the work I do at this point is even around notions of anxiety and mistrust, right? So people have angst with the dentist. I do a lot of continuing education lectures and there's no dentist that has not met a brand new patient that comes in. You introduce yourself, hey, I'm Dr. Jones. It's so nice to meet you. And they say, I hate you. I hate the dentist. And so you don't walk into Dillard's, you don't walk into Nordstrom, you don't walk into even most medical environments, right? And you meet your, I don't know, gastro doc and say, doc, you know, I hate you. That doesn't happen in other settings generally. And so we laugh it off. But what I try to implore folks to understand is they're actually sending you a very strong message and they're providing you with a very key, important piece of information, which is that one of you affected the actions and my impression of all of you. So one of you failed me. One of you failed to meet my expectations, whatever those were. One of you broke my trust, however that was negotiated. And so now I have the decisions or the acting of one person, right? One individual dentist has now marred how I view an entire profession. And in many cases, there's some good studies out now that even talk about the notion of trust and stigma. And once that is broken in the dental operatory setting, they are sometimes twice, sometimes four times less likely to return to any sort of dental setting, there's some interesting work around discrimination specifically, right? When folks have felt discriminated against, and not just racially, but across all different identity factors, when they feel discriminated against in a healthcare setting, specifically in the dental office, they're 4 times as likely not to return. So we have to do something to connect our learners and our students and our clinicians to understand it's so much bigger than, did you floss? I want you to floss. Flossing is important, but it's also connected to this larger narrative around trust, around what it means to be a professional, how we understand justice, and how all of those things show up in a dental operatory or a dental space. So that's a little bit of the backstory, and probably fast forwarding a bit to where I am now and kind of the work that's important to me now. But I think they're far more linked than they're not, right? This kind of arc of provider helping profession to ethical lens. What does professionalism mean? What does it mean to be a professional who espouses the good of the patient, the good of society above my own, even capitalistic or entrepreneurial identity or endeavors, which I push on quite frankly for a lot of folks. But I think it's a really worthwhile conversation to be having, and an understanding, particularly with the way dental care or oral health is delivered, as distinct and different from medical care or when folks see physicians. I think there's some ethical questions inherent within that delivery system that perhaps we've tended to gloss over or left unaddressed. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And there's definitely a lot of overlap that we usually talk about between the doctor or the physician, a patient, or in this case, the dentist-patient relationship within our clinical settings. Yeah, and what you said was really laid because now I know you're a clergy, there's a little sermon in that as well. But also, I also feel that there is a connection between, you know, theology, dentistry, and bioethics that I'm sure most of us have never thought about before. I feel a book coming, so I guess you got your work cut out ahead of you with that. But yeah, that is such a unique background, meshing all of these interdisciplinary fields into one. That are definitely connected in many different ways. So to continue here, I know that you've written a lot about bioethics, racism, and different forms of discrimination. I know you alluded to that previously, just explaining a little abbreviated version of your background and your journey. And it's no surprise, right, in the current and political and economic climate that we're in, how do you think dentists and bioethicists should combat racism and other forms of discrimination, especially because now of the fear of retaliation. We already know that academic institutions are literally walking on eggshells because of grant funding, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars that might be compromised if you don't adhere to the current status quo in society. So, but yet these problems still remain, right? So how do dentists and bioethicists combat racism and other forms of discrimination in the current climates that we're in?
Yeah, so I think firstly, it's really important to fully acknowledge that racism, whether that be systemically, sort of intrapersonally, that these are real, actual things, that they're real problems to wrestle with, that they are real issues that all of us in a helping profession, health professional space should take seriously. I think that sometimes folks can, and I understand this to an extent, I think sometimes folks can feel like, well, how am I going to solve the world's problems in my little corner that is a dental clinic, in my corner that is this physician, nurse practitioner space, in this bioethicist, maybe highly academic space, or even, you know, I'm doing maybe someone who does ethics consultations within a health system, right? Like, how are we to combat that? I think what we have to wrestle with and understand is that we may not solve or end racism, right? We may not end sexism, we may not end homophobia, but it is incumbent upon us, again, for me, from an ethical lens, from a professional duty, like if we think about the notions of doing no harm, if we think about the notions in the core bioethics principles of doing no harm, doing good, right? Since those are not the same, we have to think of, it has to be incumbent upon me somehow that it's my duty not to simply create an environment that refrains from harm, but how do I look at refraining, helping my patient not be harmed holistically, right? So even before they get in my chair, before they get in my suite, before they get in my hospital bed, there's a whole system that has landed them on the negative end of health outcomes and health disparities, right? I think we have to be honest also. I'm not sure the academic space was ever intended, nor obviously in the world we live in right now, is at all shaped to help end disparity. I think we may have to think about where else can we find solutions, whether that is from communities themselves and empowering communities and being a tool to help communities themselves, or if it's how we look at advocacy. The American Dental Education Association in 2022 did a landmark thing for dental education. We undertook a climate assessment of all of our dental schools and all of our dental hygiene programs. Some schools had done maybe climate assessments as a part of their, and when I say climate here, I mean the learning environment and the clinical environment, right? Some schools individually had looked at it, but we had never looked at it like as a consensus, as a profession. And, you know, the water is wet, right? Big surprise that we found that the environments are less than stellar and that folks from historically marginalized communities, whether that is racially, ethnically, LGBTQIA communities, all of those folks are on the report the worst of our environments, right? And so when we looked at that, we have a special issue of our Journal of Dental Education that's supposed to drop in May 2025. But I have a piece in there that talks about political determinants of health. And if at some point, should we examine our professional identity, our professional sensibilities, and how we vote? And perhaps worthy of inquiry is, are we able to say we uphold our professional and ethical duty if we merely vote with only our own political interests in mind versus the political interests of our patients, particularly the most vulnerable amongst us, right? I think that is one way that dentists and bioethicists at this point in the journey, we have to really self-examine and say, when and where do I put the interests of those I claim to do good for? Am I really putting their interest forward, or am I solely married to my own self-interest, even in something people would argue as personal as the ballot box, right? I think it's worthy of inquiry. I'm sure I'll get pushback, but I dare say, I dare, you know, articulate or at least pose the question, you know, for dentists, when we think about Medicaid and Medicare, right? Medicare is for folks who are a certain age. Medicaid is based on socioeconomic status. Medicaid, although a federal program, is controlled and dispensed at the state level, right? So what someone has for dental care in North Carolina, even if they have Medicaid, may look very different than what is offered through Medicaid in Virginia, for example, right? And so in the last couple of years, we got expanded Medicaid coverage in Virginia, where someone on Medicaid or someone with Medicaid as their primary form of payment is able to get the full complement of dental care, as opposed to simply, I'm in pain, you can see me in an urgent situation, you extract my tooth, even if the tooth could likely be salvaged with a different course of treatment, but all that the state public insurance is going to pay for is simply the extraction. Then we can connect that to nutrition and chewing and loss of weight, and then that's connected to maybe diabetes and cardiovascular disease. There's even connections and associations between preterm and low birth weight babies and maternal health and the presence of periodontal disease while women and birthing persons are pregnant, right? So I think there's all kinds of correlations. And I know I'm going a little bit around the bend, but I think it's just important that we individually begin to examine ourselves in a more robust way, but then collectively as professions, how do we be who we report ourselves to be? If in my selfish life, everything I do is only self-serving, and particularly around voting and political determinants of health, as it's coined and called, I think that's where we are, because that lands us here even in this anti-DEI space, right? When we look at the misunderstandings, the misinformation around DEI and the vast majority of people who even may say they're against DEI, but then when you peel back the layers and let them understand, hey, we're talking about disability access, or hey, we're talking about benefits for veterans, or hey, we're talking about you know, this, that, and the other, that's not solely the racialized thing that they think, or solely the sexual orientation thing that they think, they realize that they have voted against their own interest. Or now we're looking at where Medicaid, who far and away, I saw an article not long ago, I think there's only three locales where there is not a white majority of Medicaid recipients, and that is Louisiana, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. So the stigma, the stereotype is that these folks on Medicaid are Black and poor, but the data tells a completely different story. And now we know that some folks have voted against their own interest, and now they're realizing, man, I might not have healthcare, right? I may not have access to the dentist. I may have not access to getting to an ER in my community that has whatever respiratory machines, whatever advanced technology that's not two towns away. Now that ER has had to close because there's been some mandate that if you provide, I don't know, gender affirming care, then, you know, you don't get the federal money. So I think all of these pieces are interplayed or interwoven with one another. And I think it's important that we as both individuals and as a collective of professions really examine that and see what ways that we could be better advocates. I know for some folks, advocacy feels a little bit like a dirty word, or there's a lot of like, oh, that's not my lane. Obviously, I'm interdisciplinary by nature. I think anywhere I show up is my lane. And so I think particularly as folks who have avowed, who've made a vow to be a health professional, like how can you be a pediatrician and not think about gun violence? How can you be an orthodontist and not think about HPV, right? If I'm an orthodontist that sees majority adolescent patients, and people think of that as this very luxurious place, but think about the people now that data shows us benefits the most from an HPV vaccination to prevent cervical cancer, right? Or in our case, head and neck cancer, right? And if the orthodontist could be a locus or a site of HPV vaccine administration, what? How does that change the game? And how does that get me out of this sort of antiquated thinking of my lane is just this little place? Now, at the same time, I want folks to stay where they're competent. I'm not at all arguing for that. But I think particularly when we think about advocacy, folks often look at folks from the academy, PhDs, healthcare leaders to be leaders. And we assume these skills are transferable. And we certainly know they're not, because we've all worked for or been a part of teams with poor leaders, right? So I think we have to teach it. I think folks have to understand it. I think we have to work together. But I think in some ways we have to redefine or reimagine our professional identity, which is, again, some of the work that I'm drawn to say, okay, we have all these imaginary lines, but perhaps we need to be coloring outside the lines if we want a different result, right? We've had these same disparities, these same outcomes for decades upon decades. I would argue, do we even want a different result? And that's part of the reason we've stayed how we are. But if we want a different result where we're going to actually fix some of this stuff, maybe we have to look at it differently.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just to backtrack a little bit, because as we talked about diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI for short, that term unfortunately has been, of course, hijacked to mean many other things that obviously are false. And just for our viewers that have heard multiple different perceptions, understandings, definition, diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, AKA DEI, can you please explain what DEI is? And your description called, and I love the language you use, the beauty of many voices associated with DEI.
Yeah, so I had an opportunity a couple of years ago, a colleague and I, many of you may know Nanette Elster, who is at Loyola in their bioethics center. We co-edited a double issue of the Journal of the American College of Dentists, which is, you know, invite only honorary leadership. And they see ethics and leadership as their bread and butter, if you will. They call themselves the conscience of dentistry, right? So we did this double issue about DEI and really just trying to frame DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion from an ethically centered lens. Some of the challenge we're in, I think, currently rest on those of us in the professions who maybe could have done a better job of defining things. And some of it is certainly just a desire to co-opt and yield misinformation, right? But for me, I try to level set. Like, diversity is not just a code word for Black and brown or Black and Hispanic or Black and Latino, right? And I think that's how people use it. Just like, you know, we dress up terms like urban. Well, like, say, let's say what we mean, right? Because I think that's where we get confused. When I say diversity, I literally mean how we're all different. And so what I tell my students, what I tell clinicians in continuing education that I do around the country is, if your name is John and you are blonde and a white, blue-eyed, heterosexual male, you contribute to the diversity of this space. Because diversity is simply how we're all different. None of us are the same. And we all bring a richness in that. I think, unfortunately, it is inclusive of all the things we normally think: race, color, sexual orientation, maybe disability status, both that which is visible and that we don't necessarily readily see, right? But it's not exclusive of other things, right? And I think that's where maybe we've had a misstep, is that people only see if there's a diversity initiative, oh, you mean something that benefits Black folks? No. I mean, this is a diversity program. This is a diversity initiative. Or we talk about how diversity enriches the whole, which is really inclusion, how we leverage that diversity for good, right? So that everyone feels that they're welcome in a space. Everyone feels that they're made to feel comfortable and can fit in a space. I think equity at one point, I don't know if that's true any longer, was probably the most triggering or jarring or hardest term to understand, which really, when I talk about equity, I like to first talk about an optimal goal, right? Because I think if we can agree on an optimal goal, whatever that is, then it's easier to understand there has to be an equity lens to get to the optimal goal. So Robert Wood Johnson has a great graphic that has folks on different bicycles, right? But they're different bodily abled folks. So some might be shorter, some taller, some in a wheelchair, some a child versus adult, right? So if the goal is to simply give everybody a bike and we give them all the same bike, it's not a bike everybody can use, right? Because the person in the wheelchair can't use the same bike as a five-year-old, right? Who can't use the same bike as someone who's 6'5". We have to have an equitable lens, which means we would give everybody what they need to reach the goal. So we have to have a different conversation that the goal is a good heart rate or exercise or to be fit or to bike, you know, 3 times a week. If that's the goal, everybody's got to have the tools that they need to be successful in reaching the goal. And so that's equity for me. So that can be about a bike. For us here at VCU, I've been here almost 10 years. At one point, that was about technology and what we call digital dentistry. So when I walked into this space 10 years ago, there was no digital dentistry happening, meaning you go to the dentist, they can do a scan of your mouth with AI, basically empowered technology, and then that scan can yield different results. Whereas we used to have all that goop in your mouth and we'd be wiping your mouth for days because of the alginate and all this kind of stuff. We don't have to do any that anymore. We can just scan. Well, now, because our dean at the time decided that was going to be a very important thing for us, that was going to be a hallmark of who we were as an institution, now is something we're known for. Our students learn it from when they first come in to when they go out. But there had to be an equitable look or lens to say, okay, how do we need to train our faculty differently? Do we need to bring some different faculty in the building that come with this expertise already? Do we need to reallocate resources? And so does that mean some dollars from this department and this department are going to have to be shrunken a little bit so we could grow this overall mission, but with a reminder that this is how everybody fits the new overall mission. Does that make sense? And so I think it's gotten a bad rap, and I think we'll probably be here for a while, unfortunately. But the goal was always to deliver optimal healthcare across the board, to give everyone equal access, opportunity to be as healthy as they possibly can be. But then it requires us to have uncomfortable conversations around social determinants of health, right? Around things like transportation. And so if I want everyone to have health equity and attain health equity, then those that have purely electric cars and can do whatever they want, drive wherever they want, while transportation is not a barrier, it's still a social determinant of health for them. It just works in their favor, right? Versus someone who's taking public transportation, maybe has an Uber voucher, maybe has to walk, or the closest proximity for fresh vegetables, whatever the issue is, it's still a social determinant of health for them, but now transportation is the barrier. And I have to course correct around those conversations a lot, even amongst faculty. We've been talking about what it looks like to implement a social determinants of health screening as a part of our medical history. I had some faculty say, well, everyone doesn't, you know, need this, right? For those patients that social determinants of health is needed. And it's like, well, no, everyone actually has social determinants of health. Just for some folks, it's a barrier. And for others, it's not. And so I think even how we engage and educate and bring learners and faculty into the fold around these terms and course correct where we can is really important.
Yeah, I really love the way you talk about DEI and you know, your views and how you have obviously managed to communicate so well with different groups. Just to kind of go off that, though, obviously there are a lot of institutions that are kind of scrambling, they're waiting for research money. And if they've got these terms in, then that's, you know, whole groups of people that can potentially lose their jobs. So what do you think is a good way for institutions to sort of balance pushing back, you know, using the terms, staying firm on that, or potentially switching? Some institutions using words like belonging. You know, what do you think is a good strategy from that point of view? Sort of trying to balance the pros and cons of kind of caving a little bit, but potentially still doing the work just under another name or guise, I suppose.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have lots of thoughts and opinions on this, and I'll try to be helpful. So I'll use myself as an example. Up until March 21st, I was our Associate Dean for Inclusive Excellence, Ethics, and Community Engagement. Then our Board of Visitors had a vote, 6 minutes, resolution. All DEI and inclusive excellence was no more at our institution, right? Some folks did choose to go elsewhere. No one technically was let go, but I would say that is a technical sense. You know, so maybe for what I mean by that is folks who maybe had high administrative positions returned to their tenured department, and so they don't have an administrative function anymore. So technically, there was no firing or termination, right? But, you know, their duties are in no way the same. So I realized the reality of fear about losing research dollars, NIH funding, HRSA funding, National Science Foundation, whatever. I realized the fear that we are not in a normal political environment. And so institutions' nonprofit status is up for debate potentially, right? I realize all of that. At the same time, I have serious questions about our mission, right? What are the missions of our institutions? What have our strategic plans instructed us to be and how? And so in some sense, I'm not married to the language. If this language is no longer okay, if this language is jarring, but our mission can stay intact, then call it whatever you want. But let's be busy doing the work of mission, right? And so that's going to be different for all our institutions. I think particularly for those in healthcare, it's really, really challenging. And I don't know that I have any easy solutions if we're really trying to do the work of being good neighbors to our communities, right? Being good partners with our community and doing either community engaged research, community participatory research. My institution, I can look out the window and see our Massey Cancer Center, which is a comprehensive cancer institute, who does amazing work in trying to broaden the scope of folks who participate in clinical trials, right? You can't do any of that work without saying some of these words or asking some of these questions. So it is really difficult, but I would encourage folks to lean into mission. What is their mission? How can they accomplish that mission? I think you should be friendly with your attorneys and your higher ups to know where is that line, right? For me, while we're no longer formally doing DEI, certainly, we are the only dental school in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We have our students rotate through 14 clinical sites their fourth year around the Commonwealth of Virginia to provide care, some very rural, remote communities, some, you know, heavy indigenous populations, heavy white populations that may just be low on oral health literacy, right? We have to talk about some of these concepts in order to have optimal results for our patients. We have to talk about workforce issues and continuing to have a workforce that mirrors the population we serve. I don't have to say diversity, okay. But we still do have to be talking about how do I get more folks in school who look like the patients we serve if indigenous, for example, caries or decay rates are the worst in the nation, right? Then we have to talk about some targeted specific interventions for the indigenous communities that includes them in the conversation, right? We can't have it without them. And we honestly should probably let them lead it as well. But I think for me, if we lean into mission, then we can't morally or philosophically go astray, even if we're not using the words. My fear, though, if I'm honest, is that the words won't matter. They're going to come for all the words. So I know some folks feel some measure of safety in using belonging or even leaning into wellness. How can wellness be bad? We said the same thing about other terms before, right? So I think whatever terms people can come to consensus with and be able to have some traction and work to yield optimal results. But I would really advise folks to look at your mission and lean heavily into mission and anchor it there.
Wonderful. Can you also sort of, because dentistry works different to medicine in the whole payment structure, and you did mention earlier about it's state by state, which is similar to medicine, but what type of access do sort of underserved populations have to dental care? And I know in one of your pieces, you did have a call to action to look at the payer mix and the payment structures. So what's happening right now and what do you recommend?
Yeah, you know, dentistry is a little different from medicine in that sense. Most dentists, although demographics are changing, are private practitioners where they either own their own practice or they're in a partnered situation or group practice. More and more corporate structures, you know, may be where folks reside. One of the really interesting things I think that we don't know exactly what it's going to look like is venture capitalists are buying up dental practices. And so you may go to your oral surgeon to get your wisdom tooth pulled and have no idea. And there's no forms, there's no information that shares with you that this is a part of a conglomerate of 50 practices that this private venture capitalist, you know, organization owns, right? That is more and more becoming popular, where my understanding of it is that they streamline overhead and then eventually sell to the highest bidder, you know, a second time, a third time, a fourth time. I have real questions around patient care in those environments. I have real questions around how we get to a treatment plan and who's making the decisions around treatment recommendations. Is that actually the care provider, or is there some other formula doing this that, you know, a person who is trained in care delivery perhaps is not a part of or leading? But yeah, so in terms of underserved folks and access to care, it's a real problem in the United States. There's a book called Teeth that came out in 2017 by journalist Mary Otto that I would highly recommend to anyone interested in this arena. And it really kind of pulls the covers off of probably one of like the silent killers across the US specifically is this lack of healthcare. Really even for just the average working person, right? We talk about the fact that even if someone has good dental insurance, maybe that's $1,500 a year. Well, if you need a real procedure like a root canal, that's your coverage for the year, right? So I often explain to patients and others, dental insurance, unfortunately, is really designed to help someone who already has optimal oral health maintain that optimal oral health. It is not designed to pay for all you need to catch you or get you to an optimal place, right? It's just not designed to do that. I don't know that it ever was. And so I think that's a real even misnomer around patients' understanding of insurance. And now from a provider lens, you know, insurance is really, really dictates treatment in a sense because people only want to pay for what they only want to get what their insurance covers, which I totally understand, but it does have a lend itself to a lot of gray area where we're providing treatment solely based on what insurance will cover versus what the patient may actually need. And then it leaves out this whole cadre of people who have no dental insurance. And so they're solely dependent on something like a system like Medicaid, which is a state public insurance, or their dependent on these charitable events, charitable dentistry, which I have done some writing about with some colleagues around the notions of justice, right? Because I think if we solely look at the ethical principle of justice as merely fairness, which is often how dentists describes it, I'm going to treat people fairly, it allows us to not interrogate the systemic way in which justice is not rendered to patients, right? So then I can pat myself on the back because I go to this once a year Big Ten event where we hurdle people in like cattle instead of humans with dignity. And sometimes there's no air conditioning. They wait for days and lines. And I'm not saying we should stop those. I just think in addition to those events, that should not be the only way the underserved have an entry point into oral health care. And for many, again, average working folks, right, or what some folks consider the working poor or the working class, they're locked out of the system to really access a basic oral health care. And again, the mouth is the gateway to the body, right? So it's a disconnect even of itself from all the systemic issues that we see or that are connected to dentistry, like sleep apnea or the things I've mentioned earlier around preterm and low birth weight babies and diabetes and gum disease and periodontal disease, or even the fact that there are instances when you go to the dentist and you take that x-ray where it spins around your whole head. That's called a Panorex X-ray, we can even see in some instances blockages in the carotid artery, right? And so I've made referrals to a cardiologist to say, hey, I see these buildups even from our vantage, and that patient may have not seen a PCP for 5 years, but because they had a toothache, they've come to me, right? So there are ways that our systems don't communicate, right? Dentistry doesn't have a shared electronic health record, right? In the way that a lot of academic health systems do. So that's a barrier, and I think something that could be overcome, and that could even be a benefit of more of the corporate style practices that have larger networks. And there's an instance, I was at a meeting with some folks from Kaiser Permanente on the West Coast. And one of the things they do where they have these services co-located, right? When we talk about interprofessionalism, they have obstetrics and midwifery co-located with dentistry. So that when a birthing person does the glucose test and drinks that yucky liquid and they wait their hour before they can go get the blood drawn, they go get a cleaning. Right? It seems simple enough, but it's not something that happens on a wider scale to where we could really be more of an interprofessional team and have not just even co-located services, but actually interprofessional services offered there together. So, you know, I think it's a huge conversation in terms of how dentistry set itself aside historically from medicine in many ways, and even with medical versus dental insurance. And in some ways, we're now trying to have conversations to ask, can we be let back in the party? But it's interesting conversation. Nonetheless, one of my colleagues, Lisa Simon, who is both an MD and a dentist, who does a lot on the integration of healthcare, her and I wrote a piece around combating racism as ethical duty, right? And so how do we bring all these pieces together, really, again, to advance patient outcomes and patient success, but also have a workforce that's more representative of the folks we serve?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just for our listeners, as you know, you could go to our website. I believe it's bioethicsinthemargins.com, if I'm not mistaken. And if not, we'll, of course, correct that. But I believe it's bioethicsinthemargins.com. And Dr. Carlos Smith, like all of our previous guests, will be on there. You'll have a nice profile, a nice picture, and all of, not all, but I guess all of the particular writings that Dr. Carlos Smith shared with us will be there for you to look and to dive into some of his expertise and research. And we also had a book recommendation. So you said a book called Teeth by Mary Otto. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Teeth by Mary Otto, the story of beauty and equality and the struggle for oral health in America. So that would be on my wish list to look up and to dive into that, because it's really rarely, again, that you hear a perspective of a dentist within bioethics. And I was going to ask you the question, you sort of answered it, thinking that, you know, dentistry is an overlooked topic in bioethics. That was my question. But from what you have alluded to previously, it is. And to further that, why is dentistry an important voice in bioethics, you think? Because as you said, it's like this specialty to the side is not integrated as it ought to be.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it's interesting when I meet people and they ask me what I do. And so I often will say, I'm a dentist, but I'm a faculty member. I teach, and they'll say, well, what do you teach? I teach dentistry, but I also teach ethics, ethical decision-making, professionalism. And I've had people say, oh, dentists have ethical issues. So it's fascinating, right? As you were talking about that book with Mary Otto, you know, think about the ability for someone to get a job, particularly if they do work that's public facing. If they are missing teeth, one tooth in the front, they're so much less likely to be able to even secure employment, right? So that's an ethical issue, right? How do we connect aesthetics and what folks deem as acceptable or pleasing to the ability to get gainful employment, right? The ethics of unintended outcomes is something that I've been working with some colleagues on, like, what do we do around failure in the dental space? And how do we educate our students and even learners already out practicing? How do we educate, or have we failed to educate them on how you interact with the public and discuss a failure in the dental setting, right? We don't have metrics in the same way that health systems do. We don't have quality assurance in the same way that health systems do. A lot of it is the individual dentist's ability to see something challenging or not quite right, or sort of perfectionist sensibilities. But I think those are all huge ethical issues around how do you make those determinations? While we're not necessarily looking at issues like end-of-life care, I have heard more and more conversations about what would it look like for palliative care teams to have a dentist on them. If someone presents in hospice or end-of-life care and there's someone who grinds their teeth, right, and it's causing discomfort for them, isn't palliative care all about some comfort to a sense, right? So what would it look like to have a hygienist or a dentist a part of that team? Certainly dentists are delivering some really life and death news about, we do oral cancer screening. So what does it look like to talk to a patient about needing to biopsy this lesion we see on the floor of their mouth, which is a prime area for oral head and neck cancers, right? Also often once something is seen in the oral cavity, it's fairly aggressive. So how do we have these conversations? How do we have conversations with patients who have to have their entire jaw resected or removed because they found a tumor or some kind of oral malignancy? So I think there's all kinds of ethical issues that you all probably engage with readily and regularly that have an oral health component that folks just don't think about because they're not in that space. I mean, some of the work I've even listened to on your podcast around, you know, the health of folks who are incarcerated, right? What does that look like that the guaranteed health right for an incarcerated person, ought it include dental and oral health? I would certainly think so. And then what is the mechanism to ensure that that happens? Is it simply an extraction when something else can be done to save that person's tooth? But because they're incarcerated, we cast them aside as the least of these. So just take the tooth, right? I mean, those are huge ethical questions. And I think it's also some notion that teeth is merely aesthetics or beauty, and it's really functional. It's more than that, right? Like the number one chronic disease globally is dental decay. What do we do with that ethically, right? Right now, in this age of misinformation and disinformation and the way in which right now fluoride is being so heavily attacked, that's a huge ethical issue. It's a community, it's a public health ethics issue, you know, with communities that are removing fluoridation or some of those who have years ago, and then they see the data and now they have voted to put it back in. I think dentistry has a long way to go in our professional sensibilities, but one thing we have gotten right is prevention. And I don't know many other fields where the folks who advocate for this prevention, if we didn't advocate for it, we'd be a lot more well off. If we remove fluoride, dentists are gonna make a lot more money, but that's not the goal. The goal is optimal health for our patients and for society. So I think there are many issues like that that we have to think about. A couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to present at the American Society of Bioethics meeting on a panel around medical mistrust, right? That is a clear issue in dentistry as well, because folks don't trust the dentist. And it's usually because of some misstep prior. You meet someone who's 50, and when they were 13, the dentist didn't achieve profound anesthesia, meaning they weren't all the way numb, and they did something. And so they've stayed away all these years because of that. Or they had a tooth pulled, and the dentist put their elbow in their chest and yanked the tooth, you know, all these kinds of things that maybe did happen. I'm not debating that, but certainly shouldn't be happening and certainly shouldn't be the narrative going into a modern day 2025 root canal, or even the depictions of dentists in cinema and in media is largely so negative. I can't think of like a media depiction that's positive of the dentist. There are horror movies. They're crazy, right? And so even that is like, how do we counter that if that's the public image or the image put forth? Even AI, right? And all the changes in AI, VR. I have real questions around using AI for admissions practices in healthcare, because all the biases we hold, we're just going to put into these AI generated systems if we are not intentional to ensure they're not embedded within it, right? Anecdotally, I had a member at my church who told me they went to a new hygienist, and the hygienist said, oh, I don't really know if your gums are healthy because I don't have that many Black patients and your gums are dark. It could be disease or it could be pigment. That's the most, one of the most ludicrous things I've ever heard, right? Folks with pigmented gums, it's pigment, it's melanin, right? That may show up in the gums. But there's not even, because of that, I did like a literature review and everything. There's not even much out there that talks about it other than really in India and some Asian areas where there is like bleaching of the gums, not the teeth, the gums, right? To meet these cosmetic notions, I would argue, of whiteness, but you know, these notions that are whatever's deemed beautiful, as opposed to just saying, there's absolutely nothing wrong. You have pigmentation and melanin that is appearing in your gums. It's, you know, I would call it just a variation of normal, right? But to have a practitioner out in practice say they can't even tell you if you're healthy or not, if that's not an ethical issue, I don't know. If that's not a question of ethics, like, you know, I'm not sure what is. And so I think there are lots of areas where maybe oral health ethics just wasn't really a part of the conversation. Or I think in many ways we stayed so aligned with principal ethics and decision-making in the operatory that we haven't had many of us start to ask these larger, more maybe humanities-focused questions, broader questions of who are we, who do we want to be, how do we want to practice, what good can the profession do outside of just the patient encounter, but also inclusive of the patient encounter as well. So I think it's rife for growth, and I enjoy teaching it. I enjoy the space. I will give a plug for the American Society of Dental Ethics, of which I'm the current president of. It's a small group, but it's basically all the folks who teach dental ethics. There are about 70 dental schools. And so our accreditation does require that it's taught, but few and far between do people have formal ethics training in the teaching of dental ethics. So that's another thing that's probably a little bit of a rub. We have a couple of folks who've done maybe like clinical ethics programs or gotten master's in bioethics, but not a lot. Some folks have JDs and have come from a law vantage. So there's a lot of also legal and regulatory kind of jumbled in with that conversation. That's not in a bad way, but it's just different than necessarily the ethical question. And most often practitioners, unfortunately, are asking, what is the least I have to do in order to not get sued? Versus, to me, the higher developmental question is, what should I be doing, right? Which is the ethical lens, right? What should I be doing? What should I avoid not doing or doing? And those choices, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a correction, our website is bioethicsinthemargin.org, not .com, bioethicsinthemargins.org. So I had to make an amendment there. So our last question before we just wrap up, are you working on anything right now that we should be aware of, that we should look out for?
Yeah, I would say I'm really interested in interrogating professionalism and even our definitions of professionalism. Dentistry has often talked about professionalism in a way that in many ways is akin to one legal scholar by the name of Wendy Green. She is the legal scholar behind the Crown Act and hair discrimination. She calls them grooming codes, right? And so a lot of times our conversations are, is someone clean shaven? Are they clean cut? How do they present, right? As acceptable, whatever that may be. Well, that's not professionalism. But I think we often talk about those kinds of things when what we really should be talking about is behavior. as what is professionalism and what is the through line to, again, optimal patient outcomes. So I would like to see some sort of reorientation, reimagining, reframing of professionalism to be really clear in the oral health space of what it is and what it is not. I think the other question that I'm really interested in right now is, what does oral health justice look like? I've been in some seminars about reproductive justice, and I think they have so much to teach the rest of us about justice. Again, beyond fairness, I did some writing with a colleague around justice in oral health as anti-oppressive, right? And what does it look like to specifically name justice as anti-oppressive? And even interrogating the social contract as not benign, right? When the social contract was thought of or created, and you look at social contract theory, it's not without racism. It's not without sexism. It's not without homophobia, right? In the times in which all of that came about. So it's not a benign actor, if you will, right? Even in the spaces that we're in, often in, I think, health education in general, but certainly in dental education, like, for example, most of the deans of our dental schools have been all white males historically. So if you have some big conference room where a student has to go in for, I don't know, a disciplinary action, and all they walk by is all the old dead white men, what does that speak to someone about if they belong in this space, right? I think that's a justice issue. Some folks might differ with me on that, and that's okay, but I really think I would love to see a real definition of oral health justice that's community-led. Going into the community, going and talking with some of these very folks you brought up that don't have access to care, I bet they'd have a clear understanding or a clear articulation of, what does justice look like for you with going to the dentist or with your lack of being able to get into the dentist? There was a group here in Virginia called Virginia Health Catalyst who did a study right before COVID where they interviewed and surveyed both practitioners, but also patients at safety net clinics. And they wanted to know, what is the biggest or the largest barrier to you accessing dental care? And they got two distinct answers from these groups. The clinicians, the staff, all the educated folks said oral health literacy. The patients don't value oral health, right? Complete disconnect from the patients who said, it's too expensive and I can't get an appointment. So I think that disconnect, which is actually what the report is called, the disconnect report, lays a lot of great groundwork for us to say and define oral health justice and then get us to some solutions, again, that are community oriented so that we look at oral health through a human rights lens, which isn't really done or commonly done or commonly articulated. And I think some of our friends in medicine and bioethics would be great partners and pushing that conversation forward. So when you talk about human rights, when you talk about all the other bioethical lenses, don't leave the oral cavity out. Don't leave us dentists and dental hygienists and other team members, dental therapists, depending on jurisdiction. Please don't leave us out of the conversation so that we can get our patients the most ethically centered care as well.
Well, absolutely. We can't leave you out now. You have made such a compelling and enlightening case, but also a really cohesive conversation about the importance and, of course, the holistic perceptions of dentistry within ethics, but also with bioethics and overall health. I think it's definitely a new perspective for me that I really haven't thought about. So thank you. Of course, we could talk more. There's a couple questions I wanted to ask. Might be a part two later on as we continue this conversation. But thank you so much for joining us. We're so glad to have you, and it's been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.